Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we scour the internet looking for interesting books, and we interview the authors of those books. And this week, I'm happy to say we have Logan Byrne on the show, and we'll be talking to Logan about his book, Blood of Tyrants, George Washington, and the Forging of the Presidency. I found this book very interesting, really intriguing, because it's written more or less explicitly with the present in mind. That is to say that Logan wants to tell us what the making of the American presidency and George Washington's involvement in that mean for us today. This is an unusual thing for a history book to do. I think it's a good thing for a history book to do because it adds one element that many historians forget, and that is relevance. Relevance is a bad word in much of academic history. We are taught to ignore it, I think much to our peril. So congratulations to Logan, and I suppose to all his readers that he forewent, if that's the right word, for this particular dictum. So Logan, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, Logan, could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So I am an Owen Scholar at Yale Law School, and I'm originally from Bronxville, New York, a little town right above New York City. And I grew up, split between there and Connecticut. And I ended up at Yale Law School. And when I was there, I had to write a thesis to graduate. And so I was racking my brain. Now what am I going to write about? My background was in finance and math, so I'm thinking I can't write. So I sort of came across this issue of what does the Commander-in-Chief Clause really mean? And as I went into it, I realized that people haven't really looked back to the history and when the founders wrote the Constitution, what did they have in mind? So I thought it was important to look into that. And as I started writing the thesis, I kept finding more and more fascinating stories that had direct applicability to what we were seeing in the headlines today. So I write the thesis, and it ends up winning some awards around the law school, and it got passed around to Amy Chua, the Tiger Mom. And so she gets a hold of me, and she says, who is this Logan? And I'm scared. I'm thinking I'm in trouble for something. And hi, Logan here. She said, come into my office. So I said, okay. So I go into her office, and I think I'm going to get in trouble because I touch on, some pretty sensitive topics about war, about even torture, military commissions, debt. And I'm thinking, my goodness, I'm really going to get it now. But she says, Logan, I want you to turn this into a book. Mm-hmm. And she really starts pressuring me and really cheering me on to turn that sort of dry academic thesis into a book that I want to make juicy and exactly what you said, relevant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, your book, again, it does something that most historians almost by a matter of professional ethics refuse to do, and that is to take the past and make it bear on the present in a kind of interesting way. And it also touches on something that I think that everybody really knows, but particularly law scholars, if I can speak generically, sort of refuse to recognize, and that is that things really can't be understood, even the law, outside their context. Historians all know this.
Definitely right.
Yeah, and so many times you hear people talk about the law as if it were sort of it came down from, I always say it's written on the sky or something,
right.
There it is. The Ten right. Commandments comes right down to Moses on the Mount. There it is. And in fact, it's made by people and people in particular contexts, and they have interests and foibles and they make mistakes and things like this. And this is certainly true of the American Constitution and the particular parts of it that deal with the presidency. These things grow, I guess I would say, organically. They're not sort of, as I say, stamped on the sky. And you do a good job in the book of talking about how they developed organically. And there's some shocking things here, I think. We can say that. Yes. Yeah. Right.
I was surprised at what I was finding when I was doing the research for this.
Yeah. I mean, I think many historians of the period and many historians of, I guess, what we generically call early modern, the early modern world won't be particularly surprised that most people really liked torture, but I think many legal scholars will be surprised by this. So much for original intent. So let's begin talking about the book by getting the chronology straight. Because I think chronology is the sort of soul of history. I mean, I guess somebody else said something else was the soul of history. I don't remember what it was, but chronology. So let me see if I have this right. And you can tell me I'm not a scholar of America or the American Revolutionary period. So the Revolutionary War begins in 1775, right?
That's right.
The Declaration of Independence is 76.
That's correct.
thing winds up pretty quickly by the standards of modern wars. It's all over by 83. 83, I think that's the Battle of Yorktown. Is that when the Battle of Yorktown occurs? I don't remember.
Yes, right.
It's all over. Peace of Paris. And then I wanted to ask you about this. There's this peculiar period between 83 and 87. 87 is when we get the Constitution, right?
That's right.
What the hell happens then? What is going on? What does George Washington do between 83 and 87? And then he becomes president in 89. So what goes on then?
So Washington does something surprising. He retires. He wins the war, and everyone's saying, oh my goodness, we have our new king. You know, he could save us. And Washington says, no way. I did not fight this huge war and sacrifice so much for our liberties, only to become the new monarch. Mm-hmm. So he says, I'm going back to my farm.
All right, Cincinnati, back to the plow.
Exactly right. So he you know, the founders are fascinated by the classics, and they look back to the Roman precedents for these things. And Washington knew Cincinnatus, and he would be forever compared to him because he went back to his plow. And he was very happy there. He was very much in love with Martha. He loved Mount Vernon, and he sort of liked the tranquil existence that he had, and sort of rebuilding his own little empire there in Mount Vernon. But then, at the same time, the country was not doing so well. We were basically falling apart. What was happening was the Articles of Confederation, which was our government back then, wasn't really uniting the country. Instead, we sort of had 13 different little commonwealths that were fighting with one another. You know, Connecticut and New York were fighting. North and South, they were fighting. And there's no really unifying government because the Congress had very few powers. I mean, they couldn't tax, they couldn't stop the states from fighting with one another and imposing tariffs. So, for example, if Massachusetts decides that they hate New Hampshire and they're going to tax the heck out of anything that comes from New Hampshire, that really is bad for the economy. So, you know, the economy was really spiraling. Our national debt, I mean, this might sound a little bit like today, was really out of control, and we had very little concerted effort in trying to repay it. So what really brought everything to a head was probably Shays' Rebellion up in Massachusetts, where the same farmers who had started the revolution back at the Battle of Lexington in 1775 up in Massachusetts, they picked up their guns and they started marching upon the Massachusetts legislature. And they saw the new tyrants as the politicians in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of the country is looking at this in horror. Here we go again. Is this what the country is going to be? Perpetual war and fighting in which, you know, people constantly rising up against every kind of government, no matter whether it was a far-off monarch or even their own democracy. And that's what really was a wake-up call to Washington and the other founders that this isn't working. We need to have a new government that will be able to unite the country while protecting our own liberties.
Mm-hmm. And how do they go about that, and what role does Washington play in that business? He's back on the farm, and things are falling apart. They really weren't ever together. And so what happens?
So Washington is on his farm, and he keeps getting all these visitors. People keep dropping by his house. And it actually became so bad at one point, he started changing the signs to sort of get people lost because he couldn't handle all the company. But he was very cordial. He always invited whoever came to stay for dinner, and he'd have them stay over in rooms he had set aside for them. So he was learning from these people, and he was learning about this information. And it was troubling. So they had this idea, okay, well, why don't we convene in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and sort of we'll rework the Articles of Confederation. We'll tweak it a bit because obviously they're not working the way they are. And even just that was controversial because people thought, you know what, they're going to take away our own liberties and our states might have less power. In fact, Rhode Island refused to even attend the convention because they saw it as illegal. So they said, okay, Washington, we need you. we need your status as sort of the most revered American alive. Because people forget, even back then, he was looked upon as sort of this amazing human being who had led the country, despite, you know, his own sacrifice. So they said, Washington, we need you. Please come to Philadelphia and lend your weight to this convention, because otherwise the United States is going to fall apart. Now, Washington, for his part, he was afraid to do this because he was looking at his own legacy. He was already on top. He already had it sealed. Now he has to go to this convention that, you know, Rhode Island's calling illegal. Other people are very, you know, skeptical of whether they'll be able to really hash anything out because, you know, then now things, you know, don't really change that much. The politicians were all bickering with one another and they weren't getting much done. So he finally sees it as sort of his moral duty to risk his own reputation again and try to fix the country. So he goes up to Philadelphia. He's one of the first to arrive, as usual. He's very, you know, very punctual. And there aren't that many people there yet. And they're nervous because they're afraid that the other delegates are boycotting and that they're not willing to attend this sort of, you know, potentially illegal convention. So it takes them weeks of waiting, and then finally the delegates show up, and just enough for a quorum, and they start discussing how we're going to change these things. Then Madison and Hamilton really, they came with an agenda. They knew that tweaking the articles as the convention was meant to do was not enough. They convinced everyone to really scrap the Articles of Confederation and draft a new constitution. So now we're going from, you know, dicey to even worse. We're really changing things. And Washington, they make the president of the convention, because who else in the room could possibly have that kind of clout to keep the politicians that are, you know, at the convention in line? And so Washington is at the convention standing up at almost has a throne. He's up on a couple steps with a big high-backed chair, and on the back of the chair is a picture of a rising sun. It's really, you know, he seems like he's on a throne. So, but this is very effective. So he's at this convention, and the delegates are very skeptical of the ability to actually create a new government, and but he's there sort of as a calming force, and he makes them come to agreement. And it's funny because there's some very interesting stories that I kind of do work into the book, just because I find them fascinating, where Hamilton makes a dare to his buddy. He says, you know, go up to Washington's platform and, you know, pat him on the back and say, you know, good day, sir, and sort of treat him like a buddy. So the delegate goes up and does it. Washington freezes and just glares at him, not saying one word for about a minute. And the rest of the delegates in the room are like squirming in discomfort. And that sort of paints the picture of how Washington was able to command the room. He actually didn't even speak very much, but just sort of that presence provided the dignity to the outside world, but also sort of he's a disciplinarian at the front of the room, and it actually kept the delegates in line, and, you know, creating the new constitution. But that's not to say that they didn't afterwards every night they went out to different taverns and drank a lot, but that's a whole other story. Mm-hmm. So Washington and delegates, they come up with this new constitution, and then it comes time to have the states ratify it. And no one's particularly happy with the Constitution. You know, Washington describes it as certainly not perfect, but the best they can do. And he works with the Federalists and the Federalist Papers that were circulated, by Hamilton and Jay, and they work to convince the states that this is in their best interests. And one one delegate said, you know, without a doubt, the Constitution came into being and we were able to convince the states due to George Washington. So he, again, was the driving force. So finally, they adopt it. And now they need a new president. And it's to the point where they don't just want Washington to be the first president. They need him to be the first president. There's no one else who could possibly fill the role and provide it with the legitimacy that it needed to really survive. So Washington goes in this role, and he sort of he makes a lot of it up as he goes along. And you know, a big part of this book is looking at when we name the the president in Article 2 of the Constitution, the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy, what powers does that entail? And I looked at Washington and the precedents that he set as commander-in-chief, the only commander-in-chief the United States ever had during the Revolutionary War, and say, okay, well, when the founders created the Constitution, this is what they had in mind. Mm-hmm. And you're right what you were saying before about how often historians try to separate and keep the past in the past and the present where it is. But when it comes to the law, I think it's very important to look to see what we the people, when we created that law, what we had in mind. So really anyone who's really interested and believes in democracy should care what those the voters were thinking when they created that law. And more you're seeing this, that the Supreme Court of the United States today looks to history just like this in determining what the Constitution means. So there is debate in the legal world about originalism and what the original understanding of the Constitution was and how much weight we should give it. And people definitely have conflicting views, but when it comes down to it, whether we are true believers in originalism or not, it still impacts us, this history, because the Supreme Court says it does.
Mm-hmm.
So even look at the Heller decision from a couple years back, Washington, D.C. versus Heller, and it was involving right to bear arms. And from sort of the liberal end of the court to the conservative end of the court, they were all using historical arguments from the founding in their opinions.
Mm-hmm.
So right then and there, it shows you that this history is directly relevant. So that's what I endeavored to do, was really connect the history to today, because it really does affect us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're right to say that history is most relevant in certain specific contexts, and one of them is obviously the courtroom, because you have to figure out what happened. And people talk about the theory of the case and which one is right, and then juries decide or judges decide. And we're talking about the past here, and these things have to be, quote-unquote, reconstructed. Another one is in constitutional law, as you say. By a kind of naive, understanding, that moment in 1787 stops time. At that moment, we had decided what to do. And this was the way we were going to arrange things, and it was not going to change because we decided, and that was that. But then, of course, things continue to develop, and the distance between that time and this time changes tremendously. But we still have to go back and see what they intended, so we understand the distance between them and us. This is a very interesting place in historical study. There really is no other place like it. I think another thing to say that bears saying, and especially to our audience, largely people that are interested in history, is that what they were doing in between 83 and 87, especially in 87, was unprecedented, at least in the European tradition. And that is, they were creating institutions that had never existed before. No other country really had a president. There was no such thing as a presidency. They could not look to other models and say, this is what we're going to do. They were making it up.
They were radical.
They were, again, the idea of a republic, that was sort of new. The idea of a constitution, a formal constitution, that was sort of new. People in the Enlightenment talk about constitutions. They write ones for places like Poland that don't ever get enacted. But here, you're actually going to make one, and it's going to go into force. And it's going to have a president. Now, what a president is, anybody, it's anybody's guess, because there weren't any of these things around really in 1787. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that. What choices did they have before them when they were talking about a chief executive? I mean, one is obviously a monarch, and that would have been the conventional one. So why did they choose a president?
Right. So monarchy was a tried and true, proven form of government that they were used to. And many contemplated having Washington be the king. In fact, when after the revolution was over, Washington was asking his portraitist, a man named West, who was an American, what's going to happen with George Washington. And West says, "Oh, well, I hear he's going back to his farm." And George III sort of scoffs at that and says, "Well, if he does that, he'll be the greatest man in the world." And sure enough, he was. And and I think what Washington really was able to do was define this new kind of executive that was the answer to the people. Because this is sort of a radical idea, because the United States is coming from the English tradition in which the king and his subjects had a natural order, in which the king was sort of the father and the subjects were his children. And this is deeply ingrained in sort of the psyche of the era. But the Americans really didn't like this. They said, "This is horrendous. And if that king, father figure is not protecting our rights, then you know what? We're not loyal. And we're only loyal to a government as it is protecting our liberties." So for them, the sovereign was shifted from power in the monarch to the people themselves. And Washington really took this to heart. And they did look for precedence in the sense that they were looking at the Enlightenment ideals that you mentioned, as well as the Roman and Greek republics, to give a sense of how this could possibly work. But you're absolutely right. They were making a lot of this up as they went along. And Washington was really the figurehead who was able to do that. And one interesting point about creating this presidency and having Washington in the role was that Washington had no children. He it's speculated that he had he had smallpox in his teens and made him infertile. But regardless of why he had no children, that also meant it signaled to the people that he had no heirs to his throne or his office. So that actually made them more comfortable with putting Washington in that position, because they weren't afraid that he might, even if he was so principled that he'd be unwilling to make himself king, that maybe his son would. So he was able to define this, this new ambiguous term of presidency by being the man he was, and had learned that he would be this, highly principled, highly respectful of the citizens. And he acted throughout the war as not only liberty's defender, but just the American people's defender. So it comes out a lot in these modern conflicts regarding, when should the president use force, how should the president treat citizens. And what Washington did was he created a presidency in which that office was empowered to fiercely defend Americans from foreign foes. And so looking at issues of today, like even drone strikes, or looking at military commissions like KSM down in Guantanamo Bay, or Bin Laden's son-in-law on trial right now, Washington would really crush foreign invaders. He was really, the fact that KSM down in Guantanamo is still alive, Washington would be appalled. The fact that Bin Laden's son-in-law is on trial in a civilian courtroom, Washington would think that was ridiculous. So Washington set up the presidency to fiercely defend us from foreign foes. But at the same time, he was very careful to respect and defend American citizens themselves. So now we come to the Boston bombings, where right now we're dealing with you know, like you're not a citizen. And for that kind of offender, you know, sort of an American citizen who has, you know, gone against his country, Washington, you know, would have very little sympathy for him. But at the same time, he'd see it as important to treat him with the procedures of a citizen and the protections and sort of convict him and potentially even execute him, but do so in such a way that we're not trampling the citizens' liberties that he fought and created a presidency to defend.
Yeah, before I want to talk more about these individual sort of policy political questions, but before we say that, I want to go back just a little bit to this notion that must have been very controversial at the time, and I don't know that the what is substantively a monarch would not have the right of succession. That is, monarchy has succession worked out very well. It's intuitive that the eldest son, or at least the most capable son, and in some cases daughter, I suppose, will take over when the monarch croaks or when the monarch abdicates. This is a well-worked-out principle. It has precedence. It was in the Bible. It's all over the place. But the idea that they should be elected, that must have been a very kind of almost heart-stopping thing for them. And one of the things I guess I want to point out is they had no – and this is, it goes to the point of original intent again. They were worried about this, I think, and they had no intention of letting the people decide who the next president was. It was a very small section of the people. And it was them, if you see what I mean. They were not all about popular sovereignty in that sense. They were not going to spread the franchise to everybody. And they took lots of measures to make sure that everybody didn't get the franchise. Only they did. So in that sense, you know, we already have a moment in the presidency which really divides then from now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, if you see what I mean, it just did they talk about election as kind of a scary thing? How did they deal with this question of transition of power? This is always a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always a problem. So they, regarding transition, they weren't quite sure how it was going to work. So Washington, they decided 4-year terms. But then after only 2 terms, then they're still, you know, figuring out how this government's going to work, Washington says, okay, I'm done. So then they say, oh, no, what do we do? So then we had Adams, so, you know, that worked out fine. It was okay in the end. But you're absolutely right in this whole, you know, this was very scary to have, you know, anyone voting. But people don't quite realize that the Americans were afraid of too much democracy. Going back to Shays and his rebellion, that was almost seen as an example of too much democracy in which the people are constantly fighting, and they're constantly, you know, overthrowing the government. And instead they actually were creating a democratic republic. And they wanted to, the republic in the sense that the representatives, and there was order without trampling the, you know, individual liberties. And for individual citizens, that meant white men. White property men in some states, yes. You know, other states didn't require the property, but you're right. And with white property men in some states. And women were sort of disenfranchised citizens. Their role was not to vote, but to educate their sons to be knowledgeable in the affairs of the republic and grow up to help run it.
Right. They were supposed to civilize people. I think that was the standard line at the time. They were the civilizational aspect. Yeah, that's what they did.
Yes, they were supposed to civilize, which is, you know, a lot of this is very appalling looking back
our
present day.
Yeah,
I mean, they're doing awful things. You know, they were owning other people. They, you know, the women were treated, you know, very, you know, strangely from what we see now. But the women were seen as, you know, they were citizens, and they were sort of seen as having a role. In the book, I get into some really, like, fascinating women who were very strong. Abigail Adams is a great example.
Yeah.
You know, she said that, she said, you know, if the British shall win, they'll face an army of Amazons in America. And that is to say that the American women were very involved in not only the war, but the early republic. Mm-hmm. But again, they, no matter how many sacrifices they made, that still didn't mean we were going to give them the right to vote.
No, that's right. Yeah.
So you're right. So they said that they created a government that would have checks and balances against itself, as well as has checks against too much democracy and the masses, the will of the masses, constantly be governing and shifting and impacting the minority. So when we have the when we look at the Constitution, we see a lot of that is supposed to protect us from the masses, you know, trampling certain rights, those certain unalienable rights that people back then thought we had. So, for instance, today, when, say, you know, the majority of people all of a sudden decide that they are policy XYZ is the best thing in the world, they wanted to constrain that from using that to sort of, infringe upon people's own rights. So, say, a better example might be, say, all of a sudden, you know, slavery comes back into vogue, and everyone wants to just vote and say, okay, let's have slavery again. The Constitution is there right now. We use the 13th Amendment to say that the Constitution would not allow that, no matter how popular it might be at the time.
Yeah. I mean, and this notion that, in the early modern period, democracy was kind of a bad word, and what it meant was mob rule, and people were very fearful of it. And, it comes, theoretically, it comes sort of from Montesquieu and then later from Tocqueville, this idea that the majority will kind of run amok and do things that will trample individual liberty. They were very mindful of that because they read all of this stuff. But I want to, again, go back to this very first couple of elections. Did Washington have any opposition when he ran?
So Washington was the only president to receive 100% of the vote.
Yeah, that's really...
No one ran against him.
Yeah.
Who could possibly run against this man? He was the president. He was the commander-in-chief. Yeah. I mean...
He was unanimously elected by the Electoral College in the first election, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it sounds like the Soviet Union, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it's funny. If that happened today, we'd be like, something's amiss.
Yeah.
But for them, it was sort of... This was the living embodiment of this office. So, of course... It would be him. But you're right.
It does sound strange to us. I mean, when you think about the way those elections were handled and the way the Electoral College worked then, I mean, it seems profoundly undemocratic to us. But so let's go to some of these cases. Like, so one of the theses of your book is that the way Washington prosecuted the war had a powerful effect on the office of the presidency itself. So how do you make that argument?
That's right. So, the Commander-in-Chief Clause, this is what really struck me as a student up at Yale Law and then as an attorney afterwards. It's very ambiguous. People, this day argue over what it means, what powers it entails. Does, President Obama have the right to invade Syria without congressional approval, for example? There's this debate, and throughout history we've seen presidents point to the Commander-in-Chief Clause to... say they can do all sorts of things. And people have a hard time really unpacking what those few words mean. But to me, as I go into the research, you'll see in the book, to the founders as well, it was really not unclear. It was unambiguous what those powers were. And that those powers were the powers that the commander-in-chief, the only one they had ever had, George Washington, had just used when they were writing the Constitution. So I go back and I deliberately organize the book in such a way that I'm looking at modern issues and looking at what Washington did, often the analogy, to say, okay, well, the president today, he's constrained by Washington's precedence in this area, or he's empowered by Washington's precedence in this battle. So I show exactly what they had in mind to shed light on what those few words that we're all fighting over actually meant.
But I mean, I think as a general rule, let me try to capture the thesis of the book, at least about the presidency, in as short a way as possible. And he may disagree with this, and that's fine. But it struck me reading the book that what they said and what they meant was this guy, the president, was in charge of all military activity, and he could run it any way he wanted to, so long as it was in the interest of Americans and American liberty, period.
That's very true. So definitely they did give the Congress the power to declare war. But once war was underway, whether it was a formal declaration or Congress somehow otherwise signaled that, okay, you're empowered to go at it, once we were there, you're right, the president had very broad sweeping powers to protect the nation. But sort of going back to that divide between, foreign nationals versus American citizens, he had the power to defend Americans from abroad, but not much power when it came to defending Americans from one another.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very worried about, a new monarchy arising that would, turn on the people. And they were cognizant of the fact that Washington wouldn't live forever, and this president, would be replaced. And it made them feel more comfortable in the initial years having Washington, but they still knew they had to look towards the future. And I sort of named the book Blood of Tyrants because Thomas Jefferson said the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. And if you think about that, that's really alarming. So I think the founders were hoping to create a government where we wouldn't have to go through that, less refreshing and sort of, keep the tree of liberty, going strong as it is. And they wanted to do that by creating a president who was strong enough to protect us from tyrants abroad, but not so strong that he could become a tyrant himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the balancing act that Washington and, president today, is walking.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that, and this is maybe, again, a kind of naive view, but this is the only element of traditional monarchy that they retained. They said, when it comes to foreign affairs and war, that is, combat against people who are not American citizens, the president is a monarch. He does whatever he wants. Period, end of story.
That's an interesting point. In a sense, absolutely. They had during the debates sort of fierce discussion about dividing the commander-in-chief role among different people. And Washington had showed them, no, that's not going to work. When it comes to war, you kind of need one person in charge. Because in the start of the war, they tried micromanaging him by committee, by congressional committee. And it was disastrous. The United States military was sort of, like a squirrel jumping from one thing to another and back and forth. And it wasn't working. And then as the war went on, they came to find, okay, we need one guy in charge to protect us. Otherwise, we're going to all die. as the British were marching on Philadelphia, they got closer and closer to Philadelphia, Congress started to, wake up and say, okay, well, these committees are great, but you know what? We're losing so badly, we're all going to be hanged by the British when they arrive. So let's just give Washington the power he needs. And that sort of, that lingered on into the, the convention. And when they're discussing the Constitution, and they have this, they bring up again, okay, well, what about the idea of having, multiple commanders in chief, just to divide the power? Because, again, we don't want that, him, using it to subjugate the people. They say, you know what? We do fear that he becomes the tyrant that we're trying to fight against. But at the same time, we're not going to have a country, we're not going to defend ourselves without granting him strong power over foreigners.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, let me ask this question. Do they think of the future presidents as being military people? I mean, because it seems to me the primary duty of the president in this conception is, in fact, to defend the nation from external foes. I mean, did they think, well, okay, our king is going to be basically a general, and he's going to run military affairs?
So they definitely saw that as a very important part of the role. But it was, that was obviously not his only role, and they did see him as you know, the chief executive of the country and sort of having all these other duties. But you're right, this was a warring time, mm-hmm. and they had just gone through all these wars, and even you know, as the Young Republic and the Constitution went into play, we soon have wars, you know, the wars, quasi-war with France comes up soon, and War of 1812. So this is really, it's a struggle, and we're sort of this young, pretty weak nation surrounded by foes. Mm-hmm. The British are still mad, they want to take us back over. The French, who are allies, they were allies just to, you know, stick it to the British. They didn't really like us that much. Spain was sort of eyeing our territory. They wanted to sort of, you know, conquer more than Mississippi. So we're really, you know, in this precarious position. And we do, you're right, we need a strong president to defend us. So I think they definitely did see Washington as, you know, the perfect fit, being a military man. But at the same time, they're pretty comfortable early on with a switch from military men to the politicians. So we quickly moved to Adams and Jefferson, who were not military men. But, you know, interestingly enough, they end up being, you know, somewhat hawkish in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, they were comfortable with having civilians in charge. And in some ways, they liked having civilians in charge just because there was always this, you know, this distrust for the military, again, becoming so strong that's going to take back over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So but the one sort of, I guess I would call it the one weak spot in this argument that they had a military person involved involves the division of powers, and they do give the president the right to veto legislation, right? Isn't that true?
Right. That's
yeah.
Right.
Right. It's very rarely exercised, but Washington has the right to do this.
That's right.
Yeah. So he does have a domestic role as well.
Right. Absolutely. There is, you know, definitely domestic roles. He, you know, he's the enforcer of the laws. So the Congress passes the laws, and he executes the laws.
Mm-hmm, right.
He's also, if he finds a law to be you know, unconstitutional, he has the power and the duty to check Congress. So they wanted to create a system, you know, three branches with checks and balances, because they're extremely distrustful of government. And they're, it's interestingly enough, today we think of the, you know, how strong the presidency has become. Back then, they were actually most worried about Congress. They really, most of the debates, they discuss, you know, Congress becoming so strong that it's going to erode the powers of the other two branches. So it's funny how they worked it in there that the president could, you know, check Congress via the vetoes, and also the Supreme Court was able to check the other branches too by declaring a law unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I guess I was going to say, my understanding is that these two things, these two moments in the Constitution, the one that gives the president basically dictatorial control over military affairs, and the other one that gives him or her, I suppose, the right to, well, obviously it was him then, to veto legislation. Doesn't that cover about 95% of what a president could do then?
It does. You know, it covers a lot of what he could do, because people forget how much the government has grown in general. So having all these administrative offices, we didn't have any of that. The government was very small. Again, the states were very worried about giving too much control to some, you know, enormous government that was, you know, far away from them. So you're right. The president wasn't overseeing all these different areas of government that have grown over the past couple centuries.
Yeah, I mean, the executive didn't have much to execute, really.
It was very libertarian. They didn't have too many laws.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, that's right. So let's turn the discussion to these particular moments that are relevant to the present. And you know, you say that the presidency was forged in this sort of Revolutionary War, and they carry it forward in the person. And I think it's important to recognize in the person of Washington. It really is. It's not as if they have this abstract idea. They have Washington in mind when they're doing this. So let's begin with I think the first issue you deal with is prisoners of war. What did Washington want to do with them, and what power did Congress give him to do to them?
That's right. So this is a bit of a lightning rod area of the book, and I didn't expect to find what I did find in the history when I started this, because when you hear about Washington, you hear about his moral opposition to torture and prisoner mistreatment. And that's absolutely true. He's a very principled man, and he's more opposed to sort of stooping to that level. He wanted to raise America's conduct over the barbaric wars of the past. And he explicitly said that. However, it was only a few months into the war when he started realizing, you know what, I'm even more morally opposed to letting Americans die. So he came to find torture as a sort of necessary evil that he, you know, might need to employ in order to protect Americans. Now, there are some instances of, sort of the torture we think of, when we see Zero Dark Thirty, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Where he's trying to get information. There's this one instance where there was a woman who was caught transmitting secret information.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, she was, they were interrogating her. And they said that, she was proof against every form of interrogation we tried. And it's sort of, at length, she was brought to a confession. they do gloss over some interesting things that were happening there in that regard. But I'd say the bulk of what was happening with regard to torture and, there's some gruesome things involving searing irons and, stonings and there's interesting things called spigots, which is basically a big screw, and they screw the person's foot into it. So there's some really gruesome, awful things happening. But what they were using that for was retaliation. So the British were doing these awful things to the American prisoners that they had, and Washington had no other way to stop them but to employ the same measures against the troops, the prisoners that he held. So he saw torture as a potential tool, gruesome, awful one that he had proposed plenty of policy reasons why, we should steer clear whenever possible. But at the same time, he wanted to protect the Americans themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I mean, I think it bears mentioning that in the context of the time, again, this was a sort of enlightened view, because particularly as involved prisoners of war, the standard doctrine to that time was a prisoner of war was a slave, and you could sell them and do with them what you wanted. Now, it's true that many monarchs said, this isn't a very good thing to do, but traditionally in law, a prisoner of war, this is definitely true under the Romans, a prisoner of war is a slave. And their property at that moment, you can do with them whatever you want. Now, you probably don't want to kill them because you can ransom them. But nonetheless, that's the precedent that they were working against. So the idea that you might treat them reasonably well and torture them occasionally for information, that was kind of an enlightened thing at the time.
It was. That was a nice thing to do. He was Washington was a bit of a radical, and that he was a radical in the good sense by taking this step. I mean, sure enough, when the British killed one of our men that they captured, Washington did have his men draw, the prisoners that he held, draw straws. And he was going to shoot a 19-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't, completely, fluffy and, huggable.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But again, this was a barbaric time.
Right. No, well, it was by our standards. It was. Yeah. So let's talk about another instance. And so I guess closing that one, he thought prisoner, he would assume that the people that we have in Guantanamo are basically prisoners of war. And they're not American. Insofar as they're not American citizens, the president can do whatever he wants with them.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, that's right. So let's talk about military tribunals. What did he think about military tribunals? And what is a military tribunal?
A military tribunal, yes. So there are a couple, types of courts. So there's the civilian courts, where you have due process and protections that are set up by the legislature. And sort of common law courts have created to protect the innocent, to and sort of give, the accused a fighting chance at defending themselves. Then you move into the military realm, and there are military commissions and military courts-martial. And these courts-martial are typically, they date back to the 13th century Britain, in which the king wanted to have a way of, quickly disciplining his troops and keeping them in line. And this this type of trial, this court-martial, it would have some due process. There'd be some protections, and it was the role of the court to determine whether this military person was guilty or not. But it was faster and more definitive, and it tended to be harsher.
Mm-hmm.
Then you move to military commissions, and that's where things get messy. So military commissions were sort of a quick and dirty way of avoiding due process and providing any protections. So a military commission allowed the commander to kind of do whatever he wanted. You know, often it would mirror some of the provisions of a court-martial, but it wasn't even really a court in the sense that a military commission was not trying to determine guilt or innocence. It was trying to, dole out quick punishment. So what's very telling is the story of Benedict Arnold's co-conspirators. So Benedict Arnold is going to sell West Point to the British, and he meets with a British officer named John André, and also has the assistance of his American loyalist traitor, basically Joshua Het Smith. And Arnold gets away, but Washington gets the American Smith and the Brit André. What's very telling is the way he treats the two men. They're captured as part of the same plot, under very similar circumstances. But Washington provides Smith with a court-martial. So Congress had said people like this that are caught helping the enemy as spies should have a court-martial. And so Smith gets this long trial over a couple weeks in which he has a chance to defend himself. He doesn't really have a right to counsel or anything, but he has at least some protections where he was questioning witnesses, the people who are acting as witnesses against him. He has a chance to make rebuttals, and the officers who are overseeing this court martial, they are sworn to try to decide his innocence. At the end of 4 weeks, shockingly, despite really damning evidence against him, they had the coat that he used to hide the spy. They had all this testimony of Smith being very chummy with André. Despite all that, people are shocked when the court-martial finds him not guilty. And the reason they find him not guilty is because they say that he's an American citizen and he has a high burden of proof. And they couldn't prove, in this man, he was a slippery character, they couldn't prove that he knew he was hurting the United States, because his contention was that, hey, Benedict Arnold was an American general. I was just following his orders.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans, they weren't, completely done with him yet. They actually sent him up to another prison on other charges. But then he escaped dressed as a woman. But that's a whole other story. He was an interesting man, Joshua Smith. But then we turn to the British officer, John André. He is hanged after a couple days. He's thrown before a military commission, and this young man is actually a much more sympathetic character than even the American Smith was. People sort of like him. He's charming, charismatic, well-educated, well-read young man who, the Americans themselves, even Washington, especially Hamilton, really, they praised him for being, a brave British soldier. He really was doing his duty to, his country as he saw fit. But you know what? Washington needed to be strong. He needed to send a message. He needed to protect his people. And he couldn't, even though his wrath really was directed at Arnold, he didn't have Arnold to kill. So he had to kill someone.
Mm-hmm.
And he used this military commission to basically have, it's hard to even call it a trial, because they weren't even trying to decide whether he's guilty or not. It was sort of, obviously he's guilty. Let's just hash out the facts and then decide whether we hang him or not. And, of course, they decided to hang him. And so he was killed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting divide, going back to what I was, alluding to earlier regarding, we have, these different enemy combatants. So we have Bin Laden's son-in-law, and for some reason, we're giving him a civilian trial in New York. And then we have Khalid Sheikh Mohammed down in Guantanamo, and he's under a military commission, but there's been a lot of back and forth whether at one point we're trying to move him to a civilian trial. And there's a lot of question what to do with the Boston bomber, who mm-hmm. is an American citizen. And Washington's pretty clear precedent on this is that the two foreigners, the Laden's son-in-law and then KSM, and the rest of Guantanamo detainees that we decide are guilty, the president can do whatever he wants. Just swift justice in order to defend the nation. That was sort of their rallying cry in this regard. But then when it comes to American citizens, it was very, yellow light, caution. The president, we can't have a president who's going to become a tyrant. And he needs to be very careful to, potentially execute this man, but do it according to the proper process so that we don't lose those liberties as American citizens that the founders fought to protect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you could sort of see where this could be going. So, right now it might seem, great idea, the public, cry is like, oh, so obviously this person did this, just execute them, I'm sick of all these trials. And Washington had felt that too. There's sort of this instinct to hang Joshua Hett Smith on yonder tree the second mm-hmm. he caught him.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came down to it, he saw the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is, if I create this precedent, then what happens when your neighbors on your street are sick of you, putting your trash cans out too early, and they turn against you?
mm-hmm.
So he wanted to, create clear precedents where, mobs and the president, any faction of the American government or populace can't just start, turning on people and executing them or imprisoning them without due process.
Mm-hmm. I guess the thing that confuses me a little bit about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in particular, and about how this precedent of this British officer bears on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, is that I understand martial law, and it's important for keeping order within your own ranks. That makes perfect sense to me. I understand that when you capture an enemy in uniform fighting against you, that they are a prisoner of war and they are protected by the rights that prisoners of war have. They don't have any due process or anything like that. They are enemy combatants, as we would say today, and they get put in a prison camp and they probably get repatriated after the war. One thing I don't understand is why Khalid Sheikh Mohammed isn't in that category. I mean, isn't he just and why wasn't our British fellow in that category? Wasn't he just simply, he was out of uniform, obviously. But
right.
but it seemed to me he's a prisoner of war and full stop, and that's it. He doesn't get a process. He didn't get anything. Can you enlighten me as a lawyer on what's going on there?
Right.
I don't get it.
Right. So neither of them are conventional combatants. So they were not in uniform, as acting for a conventional army in battle.
Right. I got that part.
Yep. So that was one distinguishing factor. So Washington's sort of clear precedent on this point is that you do what is best to defend the nation. So Washington might not necessarily have mm-hmm. Decided that, it's best to, everyone Guantanamo, he wouldn't go there and start, hanging them.
Right, mow them down.
He would decide which ones he felt were worthy of punishment and would send a signal to, to their friends.
Mm-hmm.
So KSM, falls in this category of being someone who has, attacked the nation, mastermind 9/11. No one's a big fan of his, and did so outside of the conventions of war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, I mean, this is
right.
This is what we said during in the Nuremberg process. We said, so fine, the Germans were our enemies, but these particular Germans violated the conventions of war. They were war criminals. They didn't conduct war mm-hmm. fairly, and so we're going to kill them. And that makes a certain amount of sense, too. And you could argue, I guess, that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is a war criminal, too. I think you'd have to stretch war criminal pretty far. Well, I don't know if you would or not. I have no idea what the precedent is. I mean, he did kill civilians, but killing civilians in war, that's not a particularly unusual thing. Again, it's just such a confusing where these military tribunals rest in terms of what we think is right and wrong and what we think is expedient and not expedient is just so confusing to me. And I think to a lot of Americans, mm-hmm. we don't get it. Now, I tell you what, honestly, I think we should have killed that guy a long time ago. Mm-hmm. but that's just my gut feeling, and we shouldn't go on our gut feelings, right? That's not a good thing, right? You know, we don't want to do that. That would separate, that's what makes us civilized. But,
right.
Yeah.
But Washington Post would have done the same thing. he would have killed KSM a long time ago.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, again, it's a lot of this has to do with process. So, each president can determine, what's in our best policy and what's going to, protect America better. So a president could say, I feel protected better by keeping him alive and showing, putting him in a country club somewhere.
Right.
And then the president could, come along and say that for whatever reason.
Yeah.
However, crazy it sounds. And Washington would actually probably be okay with that. Because the president really shows process and sort of who has the power to decide. And it indicates that Washington saw the power of the presidency as being able to kill him or not, and
right.
sort of, create those types of tribunals to swiftly execute him and swiftly exact justice.
Right.
When it came down to it, he was very open to, I don't think he was creating a precedent where it says, the president, say, has to kill him.
I see what you're saying.
It's sort of the precedent is that he is very free to do with this man
mm-hmm.
whatever he thinks will best defend the nation.
Yeah, I see what you're
saying. And for Washington, that was, swift execution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he would say that would be mandatory.
Right. And again, so really these cases are about presidential power as much as they are about, I don't know, justice or vengeance or winning a war. And the point is, I guess you're saying, from Washington's perspective and I guess Obama's perspective today, is that it doesn't matter what we do with Khalid Sheikh with KSM, I get to decide. Period. I'm the decider.
Yep, that's true. Yeah. He has a lot of leeway, and I think Washington would probably, in that particular case, would likely advocate for this man should be dead.
Right. Yeah. No, I see what you mean. Yeah. Right.
I think that's a sort of time when your gut instinct to get the noose is fine.
Yeah.
Because again, it's a foreign national who had attacked Washington's people.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. But then, the times that when Washington would say, you can't do that, would just be reserved for the American citizens.
Right.
Because to him, citizens had rights and foreign nationals did not.
Right. I got you. Exactly. Well, anyway, Logan, we've taken up a lot of your time. This has been a fascinating talk. I have to tell you, I learned a lot, and much of it disturbing.
Oh, boy.
About our Constitution and about the president's role in it and about how much things have changed. So it certainly is an interesting book, and I want to thank you for writing it. Let me ask you our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
Right now, you caught me while I'm in the middle of an op-ed on the, getting involved in the Syrian conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of looking back to the founding and seeing what tidbits of advice and wisdom that they laid out for us when we're faced with a dilemma like we have today, where, the Syrian rebels are fighting with the government, and there's talk of sarin gas being used, and terrible atrocities. And I think our founders have some wisdom that might help guide us.
Well, God, I hope they do.
And I hope so too.
I'm not going to ask you what you're going to decide now. People have to read the op-ed, so I'll just wait.
Okay.
I won't offer any spoilers. So anyway, today we've been talking to Logan Byrne about his book, Blood of Tyrants, George Washington and the Forging of the Presidency. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History, and I want to thank everybody for listening, but I especially want to thank Logan for being on the show today. Thanks, Logan.
Thank you very much, and thank everybody.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.